Hello and welcome to this very special Emmy interview edition of Awards Daily's Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your usual host, Clarence Moy, and this week I am joined by the esteemed Jazz. And Jazz, I think we're just going to call you Jazz just because we're going to put you in the pantheon of Madonna and Cher and RuPaul. How about that?
Okay, I'm totally down for that.
Down for that. All right.
Jazz.
So, Jazz, this time of year, you are exceedingly busy, I take it, doing all kinds of things for Awards Daily. One of those includes talking to a number of Emmy contenders. Tell us what an average day is like for you when you're in the thick of it.
Oh, my gosh. So, you know, I have a day job that goes from 8 to 5. When I'm in the thick of it, I get to work at 7, and I'm doing interviews, whether they're in London. So I did Hayley Atwell. She was in London at 7 o'clock in the morning here. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon there. I've got one tomorrow for Homeland at 7:30 a.m. Then I start work at 8. Lunchtime, I have 2 interviews. And then sometimes I've got an interview at like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at nighttime. So it is all systems go, and I'm seeing movies and doing stuff for the film side of things as well. So
that's
it's
insane.
100 miles an hour, right?
It sounds like it, but you're a trooper and you are the heart and soul of this this entity. So my hat is off to you, Jazz.
All right. My head's going to get too big and, you know, nothing's going to fit anymore.
You know, I'd love to have you on the Water Cooler Podcast with Joey and Megan so that we can talk about sort of the vibe around L.A. Now that we're in the thick of Emmy voting. So maybe we can get that going in the next week or so.
Let's do that for sure. If I'm not out at some recording, you know, the other day I went to the finale taping of RuPaul's Drag Race.
I did see that.
Yeah, it was the 7 hours. I was there till like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my God. That's insane. And then you get up the next morning for your 7 o'clock interviews.
Well, that was a Friday night. So Friday started at 7 o'clock in the morning because I had an interview and I don't even know who with. I went to work. I left work early, raced downtown because I didn't want to deal with downtown traffic at 5 o'clock. If you live in LA, you know, it's like hell. And I went to that taping and it was like, I've never done a live taping before. How long is this? 2 hours? I was like texting Jen, being like, I'll be home for dinner. Like, well, you know, what do you want? And the guys, Gregory Elwood was like, no, this is like a 6-7 hour taping. I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, God. Well, in all of your travels, you know, as far as Emmy season goes, I know you just have talked to, within the past couple of weeks, you talked to Judith Light, which is the interview that you have here that we're queuing up for our listeners. Tell us a little bit about the experience. Tell us what it was like to sit down face to face with Judith Light, and what can we expect from this interview?
Okay, so I've been a huge fan of Judith Light since, you know, Who's the Boss? Like, everybody knows my age now because I remember watching that when I was a kid. And, of course, she was incredible in American Crime Story Versace as Marilyn Miglin. So we sat down and we shared our love for Broadway. So, I talked to her about what her early influences were and then, of course, how she got the role, which she talks about. And, you know, playing the character of Marilyn. And we talked about that scene, which was so heartbreaking when she's, you know, when she breaks down and says, am I a real wife now? We talked about that. And there's a few fun moments in the podcast, which I won't spoil.
Excellent. Well, we are all huge fans here at the Water Cooler of the Judith Light performance from Versace. And even though she's only in her main episode is episode 3, but she is in a couple of other episodes. She just pops up again a couple of times. And then I think she has a little bit more of a substantial role in the finale. But episode 3, A Random Killing, is really her showcased. And even though she's only in those couple of episodes, I really hope that she is in serious contention for a supporting actress in a limited series, because it's some of the best work, some of the most understated work I've ever seen her do.
I agree. And I really hope Emmy voters are paying attention. Even if they don't see the entire series, as long as they watch that episode and, you know, take note, because it is powerful as... Wait, I was trying not to sweat.
well, this is
an... Y'all cough.
Yeah. Powerful as... O-F-U-C-K, how about that?
I'm about to have a coughing fit now, but...
All right, well, with that in mind, let's go ahead and segue over into the interview. Thank you, Jazz, for joining me, and look forward to your next interview.
Yay!
So, Judith, what are some of your earliest memories and influences of film and theater and TV, going all the way back?
Oh my goodness, that's a really interesting question. I remember that when I was a little girl, my mother used to dabble a little bit in the theater, and she was always in the chorus of something, and she did A Gentleman Prefer Blondes.
Oh my gosh.
And so she brought me on stage with her in one of the sort of the ensemble scenes.
Yeah.
So I remember that. And the first movie I ever saw was with Esther Williams, and it was called Neptune's Daughter. And I always loved all of those movies, those classic movies that there was a thing in New York. My parents were both from New York, and we used to go back to visit their parents because I grew up in New Jersey. It's a thing called Million Dollar Movie. And there were always these really fabulous old films, the Preston Sturges films,
yeah.
and you know, those great Hollywood movie stars that so moving for me. And it's so interesting, I didn't even remember that I remember those until you asked me about them
goodness.
Now. They're really, and now there's TCM, which is in New York, and you can see all of those films. But there was always that kind of... devotion to storytelling.
Yeah.
How the films and television and theater changed the world or changed the culture or put an imprint on that in some way. And I remember when I was in high school, I had a high school drama teacher who was really one of those people, you know, in your life who's like really there for you. And Ruth Strand, she took us on these trips to Broadway to New York in a bus from New Jersey, and we'd all go.
Oh my goodness.
And we would go for the day, and we went to see Bee Lilly in Blithe Spirit, and oh my God, what else did we see? We saw Bye Bye Birdie. I mean, you're going back. Like,
wow,
we're talking about the originals, you know, we're talking about a long, long time ago. So it was always the excitement of the entertainment world that thrilled me. And were very much the things that I held close to me because I was an only child.
Yeah.
And so I was, it's not that I was lonely, but I was looking for where there was a team, where there was a group, where people gathered together to either perform or watch.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh my gosh, going back.
Yeah, but I mean, you're asking me about it. Nobody asked me about it, so it's lovely to chat about it.
Oh my gosh. And then you started off doing Broadway and stage work.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose that over acting?
You mean choose that form of acting rather than choosing television or film?
Yeah.
It was interesting because that's all I ever knew.
Right.
I mean, I only knew the stage. And when I went to Carnegie Mellon University, that's what I was trained in.
Yeah.
So it was just this sort of natural evolution that mm-hmm. I would go into repertory theater, which is what I did for about 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And then I went to New York and I went and I did some Broadway and then I did other things. I went to Canada and I worked in Toronto and I worked in all these other different theaters. And then I kind of fell into television when I was in New York. There was a show years ago that was called Kojak,
mm-hmm.
so I did that.
I remember Kojak.
You're not old enough, my darling.
And his red lollipop.
Yeah. My God, you do remember. Yeah. So I did that, and then I did a soap opera, then I did One Life to Live, and then mm-hmm. I did more television. I came out to California because my husband thought it was a great idea to come out here.
Right.
And so I said, why? Why would we leave New York? And he said, because you'll work out there. So anyway, so... It sort of, I got into television after I had been in the theater, and then I went back to the theater because I needed to change the perception that people had of me, and to let them know that I could do other things.
And here we are back in LA.
Yes.
Back on TV in American Crime Story Versace.
Yeah.
What an incredible show and series. And obviously your part was incredible.
Thank you.
So powerful.
Yeah.
You entered into the world of Ryan Murphy's universe.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I had done a play in New York called Other Desert Cities, written by a gentleman named John Robin Bates, and directed by another gentleman, Joe Mantello, and they've since become friends. And I got an email from Robbie Bates on a Friday night, I think it was, and he said, I'm working with the Ryan Murphy people. They are so fabulous. I want you to know them. I think they're going to be sending a script, and I want you to take it seriously.
Yeah.
It was like, just say yes. It was essentially what Robbie was saying. And of course, I trust him implicitly, and I got it, and it was remarkable. And it happened very much at the last minute, and so I had to turn my entire schedule inside out once I said yes to it. And of course, my agents and everybody said, you have to do this. And at that time, it was just one episode. It was the third episode telling the story of this woman and her husband. And wonderful director, Gwyneth Horder-Payton.
Mm-hmm.
Great script by Tom Robb Smith. Mike Farrell, who had been on MASH, who I've known and loved his work.
Yeah.
And so there were all the pieces that came together. And I always wanted to work with Ryan Murphy. I mean, there are a lot of people I know who work with him and absolutely adore him.
Yeah.
He's a visionary, and he's got a kind of clarity about the work that, and he puts a team together. Here we go back to the team.
Yeah.
And they were a team that did the makeup and the hair and the wardrobe and all of it. I mean, those suits were made for me. The makeup was designed so that I would look like her. The wig was perfection in its creation. So, and the script was brilliant. So all of that is how it all came to be. And Brad Simpson and Nita Jacobson are great producers, and they work with Ryan. And it's like, this is what it means to work in the Ryan Murphy world.
Yeah. What do you remember about the Versace shooting and Cunanan? And
very little. I remembered very little. Did you remember a lot about
it? I remember him getting shot.
I do too.
And I remember them finding Andrew Cunanan.
Right.
And
that's
was it. Yeah.
Right? So if you read Maureen Orth's book, you find out about all these stories that happened prior to the killing of Versace, which is why I don't know how much of it you've seen, but when when you watch it go backwards, we all know that Versace gets killed.
Yeah.
So the genius of this was to start it there because we all know what happened.
Yeah.
And to move backward. And what fascinated me about what I thought Ryan was doing was that the culture at that time and the way that the gay community was treated was so underground, dismissive. It was the time of AIDS. It was also the time of crystal meth. It was the time of cocaine. It was the time where the culture, you have a boy like Cunanan who's already skirting the edge mentally in lots of ways. Then you give him a family that is pushing him into the closet. And then you have a country and a culture that says, we don't really need to follow up so much on this stuff. It's just this gay kid.
Yeah.
Well, this young man, had he been supported, had he been stopped, had he been, these other prior killings never would have happened.
Yeah.
There was such a drive to be with the glitterati, with that lifestyle, with that kind of, because he felt so diminished within himself, and there was nobody who was accepting him of being who he was.
Yeah.
And so there was this drive to keep going. And so all these other killings happened prior to the killing of Versace, which I didn't know about really until I delved into Maureen Ort's book.
Yeah. What did Ryan tell you about your character?
He didn't. It was all on the page. It was all, I mean, Tom Rob Smith gave me everything I needed to know. Gwyneth Porter Payton and Dan Menahan, who directed the episodes, they gave me everything I needed to know, the makeup, the wardrobe, the hair, all of them. They gave me the landscape, the map to follow. And of course, I did research. I mean, I did a lot of, I didn't see anything of Marilyn's. I didn't want to know the way she was or the way she operated. It didn't feel right to me. And those things oftentimes, if you do too much looking at the person who's alive, get to be caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do that. I had so much rich material that I didn't have to have that. You know?
So, you know, you transform into Marilyn. And you're talking about the amazing costumes, the hair, the makeup. How long did that whole process take you to get into?
I went back to, I came back to LA. I was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we want to shoot it right away. I said, oh, okay. They wanted me to be in LA on September the 7th. And I said to them, I have a lot of things that I'm going to change for this. But there's one thing that I absolutely cannot change. And I said, and I'm unwilling to not be there for this. The Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation had asked me to open the AIDS conference in Washington, D.C. And because of my advocacy for all these years, I said, the one person in the world who's going to understand this is Ryan Murphy. And he did. And so they said, okay, you can fly on the 7th, but come in for the wardrobe and the makeup and the hair tests on the 8th. And I spent the whole day having them try on costumes, get my measurements, make the outfits for me. We did the makeup, and that took a while, and we did the wig and the nails and everything, so that it was a full day of doing that. And then Ryan, they sent all of the pictures to Ryan. He had to sign off on everything.
Right.
And so then we started to shoot. I think it was the next day. Yeah.
She is known, Marilyn is known as the queen of makeovers. Is this the most physically conscious role that you've ever taken on? I'm just trying to think.
Most of the ones that I take on are, for me, are, I like to have them be transformative.
Yeah.
Like when I did this play back in 1999, I did a play in New York that brought me back to the theater, which was a play called Wit.
Right.
And where I shaved my head and I was bald and naked. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like to do that kind of transformation. I think it really gives the audience something else to be focused on rather than me doing this part. It's like, I want you to understand this person. I want you to understand this, the psychology. That's what it means to give a performance.
Right.
And so I like to do that. And when you have teams like this, you have the ability to do that.
Yeah. One of the most powerful scenes was when Marilyn finally breaks and says, does this make me a good wife now? It's so haunting. It's one of the best scenes in the whole season. Talk about what that was like to have played. You weren't in it for just one episode. It was great to see you, you know, in more than that. But talk about that day and that scene. And
I had come back to LA.
You don't like staying here very long.
It's so funny. You know what? I like it more than I've indicated. Goodness, I mean, my husband's here. I mean, you know, we have a wonderful life here. The fact that I have New York now as well actually balances it out for me in a whole other way.
Yeah.
Which makes me gives me peace of mind, as I'm you know, as I'm being here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a great deal of success here. I wouldn't discount it for anything. Yeah. But my aliveness happens in New York. I want to run into people. I want to go to see Angels in America,
right,
and spend all day and all night there in the theater. I want to be able to run to the theater at the last minute if I want
exactly.
to. I mean, there's a sense in which there's an aliveness there for me, mm-hmm, that isn't the same as it is here in LA. And it's not comparative. It's just that they're so different.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up on the East Coast. I'm a Jersey girl. I mean, I have that kind of, I want a change of season. I mean,
yeah,
a drastic change,
yeah,
of season. So it's my aliveness happens in a different way there. But you were asking me about that scene. And the scene was, I was coming back here, and it was 2017, it was last year, and I had said to my agent, please, if you can have them not have me have any big scene the day after the Emmys, which were the night before, see if they can manage that. That would be helpful. No.
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 And if I could not have an early call the next morning, that would be helpful.
No.
That was the scene we did on that Monday, the night after the Emmy Sunday. And there was a lot to memorize. There had been much more than what they were able to use in,
yeah,
the shoot. I mean, there were longer speeches, longer monologues.
Yeah.
But to me, you have to learn it all. You have to know it. Mm-hmm. You cannot walk in on a day like that at, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning and make sure that, and like try to learn that stuff on,
yeah,
the fly. Okay. So that was part of the complication of it. But I can tell you that Gwyneth Porter-Paton, the way she dealt with me and the support that she gave me and the gent that I was playing the scene with was just so wonderful that everybody and the whole crew, this goes back to the team,
mm-hmm,
situation, conversation.
Yeah.
They're there. They knew what this scene in this episode and then subsequently what it became in the rest of the, you know, the whole,
yeah,
piece of it. It was that sort of fulcrum point. And I think they knew that everybody just was there for me.
Yeah.
In the most gorgeous, glorious way. So I felt uplifted after doing it. You know, and you do it again and again,
yeah,
and again and again and again. But I walked out of there and I felt so alive and grateful and appreciative and thrilled that I got to do it and to play that, do that work.
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean to be somebody who is so uptight and so, you know, closed in certain ways and then to, mm, let down? And how many women, it's iconic, how many women feel that? How many women live a life where they so love the person that they're with, and when they lose them, it's only them that they have, they allow themselves any kind of emotional sorrow or,
yeah,
letting that themselves crack in front of another person. You know, I think about that all the time. So many women just never have allowed themselves that. So,
yeah,
many men too, but I mean, in this case.
That was an amazing, powerful scene. And you, as you said, you know, you've always been an advocate of the LGBTQ community. What do you think Versace contributes, the show Versace contributes to that legacy?
I think it shows how the culture was relating to the gay community.
Yeah.
I think that you saw the kind of, we will treat you as the other,
mm-hmm,
we will hold you as less than, we will find you less than.
Right.
And the community never allowed that. there was no, that the, that's why I always said that the community, my advocacy was because I was so, and continue to be so yeah. inspired by the community. I mean, I'm from that age of the early days of the yeah. pandemic, and what it was doing to everybody yeah. and what was happening and the way that the country treated the community. And
yeah.
you watch the lesbian community just come to the aid of their gay brothers and stand for them and help them, and everyone was rising. And people were dying, but people were rising in the most yeah. magnificent ways. Everyone was operating from the better angels of their nature in the community.
Yeah.
And those people who stood for the community, helped, advocates for the community, allies, mm-hmm. support. You could see that it was the way Carlos Castaneda describes living with death on our shoulder. I mean, we went to funerals every week, sometimes twice a week. We were
wow.
giving eulogies. You're too young to know it, but it was a time that I can't, lives in me still to this day, the kind of beauty and inspiration. That's why Angels in America is still as powerful now as it was then.
Yeah.
And it is, the last line of it is, the great work begins. And
yeah.
it was true. It was, and it continues now, even now.
Yeah.
It must. And so when you see a show and you see someone as committed as Ryan to telling
yeah.
these kinds of stories and to talking about and giving an education and a piercing view into a
yeah.
culture at a time that hopefully will not be repeated again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think is the legacy that we leave to our young people about, and the value and the creativity of a community like this. Johnny Versace was dynamic
yeah.
and multi-talented, and was the just created this fashion empire that
yeah.
was so extraordinary. And yet there were people like Conanin that lived in the shadows. And we mustn't let people live in the shadows. We must embrace, we must comfort, we must bring together, we must join as a team
yeah.
to make the world a different place. And I think that's what Ryan was doing when he created this show.
It's an incredible show and an incredible look. It wasn't just a look at Versace.
No.
That's what I loved about
no,
it.
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't just about Conanin.
Exactly.
It was about all these other players that came into their lives that they were also
yeah.
telling the stories about. And that's great writing. That's Tom Rob Smith.
Who lives in London.
He lives in London.
Yes.
Okay, how is it working with Mike? Because
he's just...
I love him.
Don't you love him? He's just such an extraordinary human being. He's such a lovely person. Incredibly soulful, and we have this very special connection.
Yeah.
And you can see it too, I think, in certain scenes. There were scenes
mm-hmm.
that we were doing before we would start. We would just sort of improv a few things. Like there's that scene where I go out and introduce him when he's getting the award.
Right.
And there was just this kind of ease in working with each other. And I so respect and admire
yeah.
him. And then there's that scene that we have that is so simple and so beautiful, and his work is so extraordinary. And I felt so connected with him, where we're sitting on the steps,
yeah.
where he's saying, "Please don't go."
Yeah.
And she's like, "Why not? What is it?" And you could see that if he could have gone with her, or she would have stayed, which she never would have done, because
yeah.
she never missed an opportunity to work. Not in a sort of, I don't mean that in any derogatory
right.
way, it was just like she was a professional, is a professional. And you can see where in places in life, if somebody operates, had
mm-hmm.
done something differently,
yeah.
he might still be alive.
Yeah.
You know?
that was a great, I mean, just the direction of that scene, as well as the acting, right? Of course, but it captured exactly what you just said.
Yeah, it's like, and the way Gwyneth used the camera. And we were also very connected to the camera people who were working on the show, so we did that together with them. So we would say, is, you know, okay, are you getting what you need?
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to the team. Yeah, great team, yeah.
So the Ryan, you know, now that you've done a Ryan Murphy show, would you like to do another? He likes having his people come back.
I know. I would really look forward to that. I would love to. It's a world of wonderful people that he puts together. It's almost like a repertory theater company.
Right.
Because you work again with this people who do the hair and the makeup and the wardrobe, and you work again with the people who are the directors, and you know each other. And I think knowing each other in that way creates great... The story that he chooses is already great.
Yeah.
Already, the context is already set.
Yeah.
But then you have all these other people where you have this kind of warmth and this kind of connection, and you know how each other works. It's very special. Yeah. I would love to.
We've put it out there now.
Yes. Well, I just... it's so interesting. I just saw him the other night. I saw Pose, which is his new show, and it's glorious. And he's just... He gives so many people a chance. That's what I love about him. He's just... He's about opening up worlds for people.
I love what he's done. I love his work.
Don't you?
I love his contribution to TV.
I love that. I love that you said it that way. It's his contribution. It's his contribution. I mean... You can't say that about everybody. You just, but him, it's very, very special.
Yeah. So what's next for you, Judith?
Well, I have a couple of things that I can't talk very much about because they're in process, but it's a couple of films.
Okay,
and so
exciting.
That might be for this summer, but when I can talk about it, I'm happy to talk
to you
again.
We're going
to
do that.
Absolutely.
We are going to do that.
Just grab a hold of Alan or Michelle or get them and we'll talk about it. Even if we talk about it on the phone.
We will do that.
As soon as I know. But when people are in the planning stages of finishing up things, I just don't like to say too much. So it's very, you know, really, I'm very excited.
Oh,
very much looking forward to it.
I look forward to that.
Yes,
Judith,
please.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Really.
Out. Can't keep my It's all so clear to me now. And I can't help but fear that certain sadness here.